The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for the last few weeks, we've been exploring in this group ways that, you know, suffering. A lot of us come to practice through meditation because of a contact with suffering and the promise, in a way, that Buddhism offers, that there are explorations we can make with practice, with meditation, that will help us to basically live a happier life, to be more at ease, to understand how our mind contributes to our struggles and our suffering. Now, there's the objective, what's happening in the world, which is going to be pleasant and unpleasant, sometimes really unpleasant. You know, it's not that that's going to change, but what the exploration around our meditation and mindfulness practices to look at what happens in our minds that adds to our suffering. What happens in there that creates what Gill sometimes calls optional suffering. You know, so there's the objective experience of pain, for instance, and then there's all of the way we hate it and get mad at ourselves for, you know, maybe having cut ourselves with a knife, or so, you know, there's the pain that happens, and then there's all kinds of reactivity. And while it sometimes seems like that reactivity is, you know, just part of being human, it is a part of being human, and yet it is not a necessary part of being human, that reactivity. And this is a place that we really explore, looking at our reactivity. This is one of the ways that our minds adds to experience. There's a huge difference between cutting yourself with a knife and knowing the pain of that. I mean, bodies are designed to feel pain, so, you know, pain is not going to go away. And if we cut ourselves with a knife, you know, that will have some pain. And yet the anger about that, the reactivity, the fear, the confusion, the frustration, all of that compounds the situation in the moment. And the whole experience the Buddha talks about, when we experience some unpleasant physical sensation, our mental reactivity to that, he says, it's as if we've been struck by an arrow, and then we pick up another arrow and strike ourselves again. That reactivity is an added part of the suffering in that moment. And while it may seem that, you know, that reactivity is necessary, I mean, I think one of the big mistakes we make is thinking that reactivity is how or why we do things. It's like, if I'm not afraid, if I'm not angry, if I'm not upset, would I take myself to the hospital to have that looked at? Well, yeah, you would. You know, it's like, there's a cut there. What's skillful right now? I actually had this happen. I was on a 10-day retreat at my home, and I cut myself with a knife. It needed stitches, and it was kind of interesting. So it's like, oh, wow, okay. Hold it. It's like, looks like it's not going to stop. I got to do something about this. And I knocked on my neighbor's door because I felt, you know, I've been meditating for probably a week, and it's like, I don't want to drive myself to the hospital here. Knocked on my neighbor's door, and I said, you know, I cut myself with a knife, and I think I need to get to the hospital. And I think it was a joke, but, you know, she said, don't panic! that's the typical kind of reaction that we have. And it's just like, I had been meditating, and it was like, the mind was just pretty at ease. It's like, oh, need to get myself to the hospital, okay. So it's not necessary. The reactivity side of things is extra. And so we've talked about that reactivity piece of it. I'm not going to explore that further today. And we talked about views as a place where suffering and struggle gets added in our experience. Views about who we are, what we're capable of, ideas, opinions, agendas. You know, so much suffering in this world comes from opinions. Our political primary season is such a demonstration of this, how opinions are a force. They can be a force for good in the world, but they can also be a source for suffering in the world. And so recognizing that opinions, views, beliefs are, I think one of the keys around this in terms of looking at the adding piece of it is to recognize that they are opinions or views and beliefs and not truth. And that a lot of the conflict and suffering that happens around views and opinions is when people hold to them as truth. And so this is another exploration, not to say I'm not going to have any opinions or views, but to recognize this is a view, this is an opinion, and to begin to see how much suffering comes because we cling and hold to opinions and views. So this is another area that we've explored in the past few weeks. And last time I talked about concepts being an area where, well, this is an even subtler form of how addition happens. And again, you know, concepts are necessary in our lives. We're going to walk through the world having concepts about things. The place that this begins to catch us is again when we take our concepts to be reality. This is this can be very subtle. I mean, like in this room, for instance, my experience, my actual experience right now is that there are people sitting out here, and there are chairs, and there's walls, and yet I know internally that this is all concept. You know, it's like what my experience of the world, I'm not one of the mind-only school people that I think there's nothing out there, that it's all constructed by the mind. So I think you're out there. But my experience, what I know of what's coming into this being is mediated through this mind. I can't really know what's out there. I can only know the reflection of it as it's experienced in my mind. And because of that, you know, because of that that mediation of the mind, it's like we are living with a reflection of reality, and that's all that we can live with, is this reflection of reality. And if we don't know that what we are living with is a reflection of reality, if we take that reflection to be actuality, there's a big doorway for suffering to enter there. That much of the time that reflection of reality is, you know, pretty good, and we navigate the world and have conversations and you know, manage to drive down the freeway with these concepts and this reflection of reality. You know, so I'm not saying we want to get rid of concepts in any way. And yet, that because what we are experiencing, all that we experience is mediated through the mind, there's a huge avenue for views, opinions, ideas to get associated with concepts. Certain things that we take in are seen as good or bad based on the concepts. And then a whole host of other things can happen from that. I think I mentioned, you know, race relations as being one of these areas of how concept and our relationship to concept brings suffering into the world. You know, race itself is a construct of mind. It's a concept. And yet so much suffering arises around that concept. So this is another area to explore in our experience around adding, that to recognize, again, not to get rid of concepts, like I'm not suggesting that we get rid of opinions, but to recognize their opinions. Recognize that what we are experiencing is mediated through our mind, and that, well, when there's suffering, some concept is at play. The place I'd like to explore today is a concept that we all share pretty uniformly, that of the sense of I or me or mine. This is the sense of self, and this concept, it is a concept, and again, it's taken to be a reality. It is like not questioned. For me, at least, it wasn't even questioned until I heard this teaching, you know, that self is a construction. It's a construction just like my sense of you is a construction in my mind. My sense of me is a construction in my mind. This is actually not just a Buddhist teaching. It is a pretty well established in the psychological world these days. If you do any reading or looking at psychological literature and neurobiological literature, one of my dear friends, a professor of psychology at Yale, wrote a whole book around what the title of the book was called The Remembered Self. Basically, the self being constructed through memory. And then there's another book that I read a few years ago. I pulled it out this morning as I was thinking about this talk and just flipped through it. It's got some really interesting thoughts in it. It's a neurobiological exploration, a particular perspective. So this is a theory that this person offers. But this the author is Antonio Damasio. And the title of the book is Self Comes to Mind. And he is looking at the evolution of the sense of self through looking at evolutionary biology. You know, how does this sense of self come to be in our evolutionary, in what happened evolutionarily? And so, you know, the understanding of the self as construct, it's not just a Buddhist idea. But I'd like to explore it in terms of a way that adding happens in our being. It's very natural for this sense of self to be born. We could say that it's kind of part of our neurobiology that this sense of self is born. It's not what I would call hardwired, though. And it's not a thing. That's an important piece, that there's some idea we have of some entity that is I or me, that owns things, that has things that are mine. And that's the piece that is useful to begin to question and explore. The notion of self, I think, it seems incredibly obvious, because that's kind of, it feels like the reality we're living in. You know, we don't even question it. And I certainly, as I said, I didn't question it until I met these teachings. But when we even start to look at it a little bit, we begin to recognize, I mean, if we just look at what do we take to be me throughout the day, you know, if you just look throughout the day to day, you know, what is it? What is the sense of self that you're experiencing right now? Are you the person sitting here listening to a talk? Are you the person who's thinking about perhaps something they need to do later in the day? Are you the person who's in relation to a particular other person? So right now my experience is in relation to sitting up here and being in the teacher role. And so there's that role is part of what's happening right now in my experience. I don't have to own I am a teacher. It is just the process that is unfolding here. So for each of us during the day, like, you know, when I leave this place, I'm no longer hopefully carrying around a teacher role. You know, when I'm in the grocery store, you know, if I were carrying the teacher role into the grocery store, people might think that was pretty strange. If I, do you know that you don't exist? You know, that might be kind of strange to have that kind of conversation with the cashier. So, you know, in relationship, you know, are we, who are we as we go through the day? As I started exploring this, I saw that my sense of self really shifted radically, not only depending on what I was doing, but what I was thinking. So I might have a thought of my mom arise in my mind, and suddenly, whew, the whole experience of sense of self comes to be the daughter. Or I might be having a memory about having a conversation with a colleague, and whew, a whole kind of congealing of a sense of who that I am in relationship to that colleague comes to be. So not only is it based, the sense of self based on what we're doing moment to moment, but it's often based on what we're thinking. And so this can be a very interesting reflection. Tanisaro Bhikkhu points out that there's not just one sense of self. There are many senses of self. And he has a title of a book, I think it's called Selves, with plural, Selves and Not Self. That the exploration around understanding this notion that the sense of self is a construction can begin to happen as we see there's so many different experiences that we call self. So even beginning to make that exploration, one famous Zen teacher put the path of practice in the perspective of this exploration. He said, to study the way is to study the self. Or we could say to study the way is to study the selves, the senses of selves. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be awakened by all things. And so as we make this exploration, we begin to recognize that what we thought was I or me or mind is a construct. And so it begins to kind of shake up that notion of I, me, mine. And that that releasing of that congealing around identities begins to, I guess I need to talk a little bit about why is it helpful to begin to recognize this? You know, why is it helpful to begin to recognize that what we take to be something solid and real is not, that it's a construct? A lot of our suffering, a lot of our struggle in life comes because we have congealed around a particular identity. If we've congealed around a particular identity, I mean, I congealed around a lot of unhelpful identities in my life. Miserable. I was definitely identified with being miserable. And this one is obviously suffering. You know, this one, the whole being was congealed around being miserable and feeling impinged on and feeling like put upon and feeling like, you know, oh, woe is me. Why me? Why am I always so miserable? And the congealing around that was powerful because when there were moments when I was not feeling miserable, the mind would say something like, it's like, well, yeah, I'm happy now, but I really know what I am is miserable. So there was a tendency for the mind to prefer to congeal around those negative states, instead of congealing around the positive states. Not that congealing around the positive states is actually any more helpful. But it was interesting to see, you know, there's this flow of experience. You know, what do we choose to congeal around? You know, I could have, some conditioning could have had different impact on me, and that maybe had me congealing around being a happy person. That wasn't my conditioning. My conditioning was around miserable, self-hatred. And so, you know, that kind of identification is obviously suffering. You know, it's pretty unpleasant to feel like I'm a bad person, I'm wrong, I'm a failure. You know, that experience itself is pretty challenging. So there's suffering in that. There's suffering in the identification with these negative or unhelpful states. So what about the other side? What about identifying with, you know, being the one who's in charge and control and, you know, having things together? You know, it's not a problem when things are, you know, going our way, or when things are, you know, following, you know, if we're acting in the world and things are moving in the direction that we have set our course for. It's not that we're trying to stop that from happening, but the ownership of I am the one who's doing this. I am the one who's making this happen. There is a process going on in our being that is choosing, that's deciding, that is having, you know, filtering the input and making decisions based on conditions. That is happening. And yet there's an extra thing that goes on that kind of says, well, I'm doing that. So again, there's a congealing around this. I'm the one who knows how to get things done. I'm the one who can make good choices. I'm the one that can succeed. And, you know, the nature of life is that sometimes choices that we make will go our way and other times they won't. And so when we are identified with that, when we are identified with that sense of being the one who is successful, at least in my experience, this kind of sets us up in a way when things don't go our way. You know, if things don't go our way, there can be a kind of the crash of, maybe I'm not in control. And so there's this ebb and flow sometimes between those identities of feeling like we can do things well and these identities that we feel like we can't do things well. And then sometimes there's the suffering that comes from a strong sense of identity that is basically almost like a bully. You know, it's not so much that we would be experiencing the direct suffering of that internally, but that it can create suffering in the world. You know, I'm thinking of one of our presidential candidates. You know, this way of being in the world that is so ego-based and so sure of rightness, and how that is, you know, rippling out into the world and creating suffering. So I would propose, actually, you know, even though it might appear that a person who's in that place of very strong ego, just kind of, you know, in that, you know, bull in a china shop kind of experience, kind of place, that they may, that it might not look from the outside that they're experiencing any suffering or struggle in themselves, I would say that at some level in their being, there is some pain that has them doing this. Some sense of really needing to protect something, defend something. So there's just so many different ways that we can identify, and so many different ways that holding to that identity, it's really the holding to the identity, the congealing around it, that is the place where the suffering comes in. You know, we have relationships. We will go through this kind of flow of what we might think of as identities in a way. But if we can recognize, this is the kind of identity that's here now. You know, it can be here right now. I mean, it's useful for me in this moment to have the role, let's call it a role rather than an identity, to be in the role of teacher. It's useful for me to do that right now. So that, you know, to recognize this role comes and goes. It's a conditioned phenomenon. I don't have to kind of congeal around it or own it or be that person. So these selves, these senses of selves as conditioned processes, you know, that I think in some ways they come into being for a bunch of different reasons. Some in relationships. I mean, you know, we have different strategies or different senses of self that come into being based on, you know, friendship or parents or children or co-workers or bosses or people we don't know in very well, in different senses of self. And if you explore this, you'll begin to see the different senses of self that come into being with the different relationships that you are going through your day. There's also different senses of self, I think, that come up as strategies for navigating life. This is another thing that Tanisaro Bhikkhu points out a lot, that the sense of self is often a strategy, or our various senses of selves are strategies. And essentially those strategies are trying to help us find a way to navigate the complexity of the world. You know, the fact that things are impermanent and unreliable. You know, the strategies that we have to meet the challenges of life. We, through conditioning, we come up with various strategies, and often these strategies are born early on in our lives. You know, a lot of these strategies are created based on, you know, particularly the early relationships with our parents and how those relationships formed. You know, Some family relationships have certain patterns that appear a lot, and a strategy is born in relationship to the family patterns. So these strategies, the senses of selves are often these strategies for navigating what we've come to meet a lot in our lives. And then what happens is that a process in our mind then starts to own that strategy as being who I am. And so the strategy has happened. The strategy has been conditioned based on culture, based on family, based on patterning. You know, it's like our senses of self are not simply our own creation. Our senses of self are co-created by our culture, by our families. You know, what we receive in our families shapes us. What we receive in our culture shapes us. And then we, in turn, shape the culture through how we interact. And so it's this back and forth process of self and culture being shaped. Our sense of self, I'll have to use, a sense of self and our culture being shaped by each other. And so these strategies happen very naturally. You know, we go through the world and it's like we can't help but have these strategies happen. And then there's something in our mind that begins to own those strategies as being I or me or mine. And then that owning of it being I or me or mine creates a sense of something to defend, something to protect, something to hold on to. So, you know, one example of, you know, this kind of conditions creating a sense of self. This is a simple one in my life. So, I have really bad eyes. And this started happening when I was 5, something like that. And I think before, I don't think I got glasses until I was 7. But I guess the teachers kind of knew that when I was sitting closer to the board that I could read what was on the board. So they always put me in the first row. You know, so the fact that my eyes were bad and I was very short, both of those things ended up, you know, just the physicality of my being ended up having me in the front row in school. Because, you know, this is all kind of understanding in retrospect. Because I was put in that position over and over again, that's where I got comfortable. That's where this being, you know. So it wasn't that I chose to do that, but that's what happened because of the configuration of this being. And so I got comfortable in the front row. And then as I aged, I mean, I remember certain things happening. Like whenever I would go into any room where there was, you know, some kind of presentation being given, I would go to the front row. And it felt like I was choosing to do that because I was a very, like, engaged person and interested in what presenters had to say. You know, owning that sense of identity. I mean, this is a pretty trivial example. I don't think much suffering arose based on this pattern. But you know, but this is a kind of example of how a sense of self is conditioned and is created. All of our senses of self are this way. Let's see. There's so much to say about this. We may have two meetings on this topic. So in our exploration of senses of self, really, I think coming back to what Dogen said, you know, to study the way is to study the self. It's not to try to get rid of the self. It's not to try to fix or change that, but more to begin to be curious about it and begin to recognize that there's some beliefs and views around sense of self that are just not true. You know, this ownership of I am. You know, there's different ways that we own experience. The Buddha pointed to this in a very succinct teaching. He said, in our experience, the sense of suffering is created through clinging, holding on to things. And very succinctly, he pointed to a way to explore this clinging. He said, nothing should be clung to as I or me or mine. So this points to three different ways or three different dynamics in our minds around the sense of self. The easiest is ownership, mine. You know, this one is the sense of being a possessor. You know, that's the sense of self that's there. It's often the feeling is, this is mine. And so we're oriented around an object. You know, this is my glass, at least for right now, you know. So, the ownership, the feeling of ownership reveals that there's a sense of one who owns. So that's one place to begin to explore. When does it feel like there's a sense of mine? We have the sense of mine around objects, possessions, relationships. You know, jealousy is born out of a sense of possession with relationship. Children, yep, children are mine, and Children are their own. You know, this is, I think, you're really pointing to that, you know, that moment when, or not the moment, but that process of children really becoming their own being, you know, and how that can be very hard, you know, to let go of. So, yeah, that possession kind of thing, you know, looking at that, exploring it. Now, again, not to say get rid of things or to try to deny that it feels like there is one who owns things. But again, to explore it, to recognize it. Oh, this is the feeling of possession. What is that? What's happening there? Then there's the sense of I. The distinction between I and me is an interesting one for me, at least. For me, and this is just my own exploration. The sense of I, to me, feels often around the I as an agent. You know, I'm the one who does things. I'm the one who chooses, decides, acts. And so the I is subject, you know, the subject of the sentence. I go, I think, I... So the I is the one who is active. There is also the sense of I being, you know, the phrase I am. That sense of I am is actually one of the subtlest kind of feelings. And I think that one is the one that really, you know, that's probably one of the deepest ones to begin to get familiar with. You know, I am, that feeling, I am. Really, it feels so true, it feels so right, it feels so obvious, I am. And yet, you know, looking at it again, you know, I am the one who what? I am the one who chooses to sit down to meditate. I am the one who can stay connected to the breath. I am the one, you know, so again, the connection with the doing in a way. Often that sense of being is connected in a subtle way to some doing that's happening in the moment. And so, you know, being in meditation, I am here. And yet, you know, what happens there? If I am the one who is being present, who is the one who wanders? Who is the one who gets lost in thought? So there's that. You know, this truth or this recognition that the sense of self is not what we think it is staring us in the face all the time. You know, this sense of, okay, I am going to do something. I'm going to sit down and pay attention to the present moment experience. That I dies in some moment that the mind gets hooked by the sound of a motorcycle and starts thinking about motorcycles and gets lost in thought. I mean, who did that? Who wandered, you know? Conditioning wandered. Conditioning, the habit of mind wandered. And then even more remarkable is the moment when mindfulness returns. You know, who did that? You know, in that moment of mindfulness returning, often we identify in retrospect with having been wandering. So, oh, I was lost in thought. And so again, after the fact, this is a really interesting thing to notice. I is created after the fact. I'm the one who sits down to meditate. The mind wanders. I didn't consciously choose to have it wandered, so the I was not doing that particularly. The conditioning was doing that. But as soon as the mind returns, the I is born and takes credit for the wandering and often creates the sense of it being a bad thing that it was wandering and judges itself. And so there's some suffering around the creation of self right there in a very simple way. It's like the I was born after the fact. The mind wandered. The mind came back into present moment awareness, took credit for the wandering, and judged itself for it. So this sense of I being the doer, the actor, it's very interesting to see how the attribution of that self, it's after the fact. Something happens, a choice is made, and then the mind, the sense of self is born that takes credit for that decision. And then there is too, it is true that the process of the creation of self is itself a condition, it's something that feeds into this system. And so there can be a sense of self that's born, that I'm the one who's in control, and then decisions are made based on that sense of self. And so sometimes there is also the further activities that we get engaged in that come because that sense of self has been created, born, and identified with. In a way, the judging mind around the wandering is just an example like that. It's like the mind wandered, it noticed it wandered, so it then took credit for being the one who wandered. And so that's the sense of self that's born, is that I was wandering. I did that. And then, because of that identification, the mind judges itself. And so that judgment comes as a result of having that identity. So then there's the me side of things. In my own exploration of this, you know, when I first heard this teaching, you know, nothing should be clung to as I or me or mine, I wasn't so clear about the difference between I and me. Just beginning to explore this and looking at it, you know, we can think about it as the position of the word in the sentence in a way. Me is what things happen to. It's the object of the sentence. You know, things happen to me. So this is the sense of self that doesn't feel like it's in control, that feels like it's impinged on. The woe is me kind of experience. You know, it's like, poor me, you know, things happen to me. That, again, that sense of, a creation of an identity around, you know, being impinged on. At one point in my practice, I was on a long retreat, a couple-week retreat, and it began to be very clear to me, and this, again, you know, we can see this in our meditation as we begin to look at what's going on in there. You know, it's kind of amazing. All this stuff happens all by itself. You know, we don't we're sitting here and there's hearing that's happening. It's like, wow, I didn't do that hearing. It just happened. Knowing happens all by itself. It's amazing. And so I was in that place of just like, wow, everything's happening by itself. And yet, it sure felt like it was happening to me. So I wasn't in control of what was happening. But there was a way in which I felt like, yeah, it's me. It's me that it's happening to. I'm the one who... Or the me is the one that experiences feeling, and so it's the being, the experiencer in a way, is that sense of me. This is a fairly subtle sense, also I think, kind of connected to that deeper sense of being. And so again, you know, the idea here isn't to talk about this and then have you, you know, go dismiss and say, oh, a sense of self, that's an illusion. I shouldn't have that. The practice is to study it, to get curious about it. The very curiosity around, what is it that you take to be I? Oh, a sense of mine is coming up. What's happening there? A sense of me, something happening to me, out of control, but a sense of me there. What's going on? You know, what is that experience? So the practice always encourages us to investigate, to be curious about, not investigate, think about, but investigate the actual experience. What is the experience of me? What is the experience of I am the one in control? This process of exploring the sense of self, you know, it sometimes can be kind of subtle, and I wouldn't encourage it. You know, sometimes people, you know, might hear a talk like this and then try to go out and, okay, what is happening? You know, what sense is, I don't know what sense of self is here right now. It's just like, yeah, it feels like there's a sense of self, but I don't know what it is. That's okay. You know, just like, oh, well, it feels like me. Okay, that's good enough. The teachings around this phenomenon of adding a sense of self, of identifying around the sense of self, points to the, there's a process, the Buddha talks about, a process by which this sense of self is constructed. And as I said, you know, it's a conditioned phenomenon, you know, just in the everyday language, you know, there's, you know, actions and conditions that happen in the world that feed back into us that creates this sense of I am, or, you know, who I am, the I am the one who sits in the front row, you know, that kind of thing. There's this cycle of conditioning that creates, has that our mind picks up and creates the sense of self. The very same cycle, the very same process is also used to describe how suffering comes to be. It's identical process. It's kind of a different place in that stream of experience where we might experience stress, dissatisfaction, unease, suffering, pain, anxiety, you know, various forms of suffering, from the subtle to the obvious. And the sense of I am. But where the this teaching points to whether we are noticing a sense of self or whether we're noticing some sense of unease, a sense of, ah, oh, wish it were different. You know, we don't have to try to figure out who is the I who wishes it were different. The feeling of wishing it were different is enough to look at. Right there in studying, in exploring, oh, what is this feeling of unease right now? Always the encouragement to come back to what is the actual human experience that's happening right now in our practice? What is this experience of wish it were different? There is the I in that sentence. I wish it were different. But sometimes the sense of I is not so obvious. The wishing it were different can be obvious sometimes. And so whatever's obvious, oh, wishing it were different, the feeling of dissatisfaction, that's what's happening. Exploring that, being with that, may begin to reveal some beliefs or views or a sense of who it is that wishes it were different, or the ownership of believing that I should be able to control that it shouldn't be different. All of that can be revealed just by, you know, meeting what's here, what's here. Sometimes the sense of self is really obvious. You know, sometimes the sense of self stares us at in our face. You know, like on retreat, sometimes we might find ourselves comparing. Comparing is a place often where the sense of self is strong, like, oh, I'm better, or I'm worse. And so when we hear that kind of comparing mind happening, that's a place to feel into what is that, ooh, that sense of I am, that ownership of, yes, this is me. There, up at Spirit Rock, there are these wild turkeys on the land. And, you know, they run around and, particularly in the spring, I was up there not long ago, you know, the male turkeys are in their full-on display mode, and, you know, they go, you know, they puff out, and you know, they're strutting around with their tails in the peacock mode, and they're pretty impressive looking, you know. That feeling, that's kind of what it feels like to be in a sense of self. It's like, here I am. You know, what is that feeling? Oh, I am better. I am worse. Maybe it's, now, what is that feeling? What is that experience? Noticing it. That's the encouragement. We have to stop now. So I think I'll continue this in some fashion. I'm away next week teaching a retreat, but I'll continue this in some fashion next time, trying to talk for shorter so that there can be opportunity for questions, because I think this is a great place for exploring experience with a question and what you actually notice. So a couple weeks from now, we'll have that conversation. So thank you.